I'm Jeff Burton. I'll be the chair of this session, the successful Borderlanders. We have to have quiet because we don't have a microphone. And there is a microphone right here, and anything you say will be picked up. So we have to be a little circumspect here about what we say. But anyway, I'm going to introduce our session, and then each of us is going to take about 10 to 15 minutes, which would leave us plenty of time for you to ask questions of this distinguished panel. And I'll introduce them each as they prepare to stand up. But we have Brad Carmack with us here today, and you know Mary Ellen Robertson and Dan Witherspoon, and I'll give you a little more information about them as they prepare to stand up. When we get to the question session, what I'd like you to do is maybe stand up and either come a little bit closer or at least speak carefully so that we can pick your question up on the microphone. It's kind of an exotic system here. But anyway, the sixth or eighth time we've had this session. It's been kind of fun. Just out of curiosity, how many have been to one of our sessions before? So, okay, thank you. So that the rest of you are new to it, which is pretty common. We see people kind of going through the borderlands, unfortunately. I'd like to see more people stay, but it kind of follows the church's own statistics say that during their lifetime, about 80% of people who are baptized either are excommunicated, leave the church, or go inactive. Some come back, of course, which is good. But that kind of, I think, represents the kind of thing people get, for one reason or another, they find themselves disaffected, and then they get in the borderlands, and then most travel on through. And we, if you're on that journey, we hope to make it a pleasant journey for you. If you can stay, which is what our goal, of course, is, we want to make your stay in the borderlands as pleasant and helpful and hopeful as it can be. There are some who leave, and we wish them Godspeed. But there are a lot of people who want to stay, who have to stay. They've got a job, they've got a spouse, they've got a family, they've got tradition. They just want to stay. I like it here, but I got these problems. You know, whatever it is, so all of us have a different reason for entertaining the idea of being in the borderlands or on the fringes of acceptability. So we're going to talk about the successful way to do that. And after we get done, of course, we'd like to ask you to share your questions with this expert panel, or give us a success story, a short one that, you know, how you managed to cope with something. Did you all get a copy of my little checklist? I'll speak about that first, and then we're going to turn on. I guess we'll just... Do you guys have any choice on order of how you will speak, or... I guess we'll just go down.
I'll be the filling.
Okay.
Okay. If you take a look at this checklist, what I'd like to do is just go over quickly with you and give you a few ideas and a few stories from my own life and from stories I've seen over the past 25, 30 years. You know, literally hundreds of people have contacted me one way or the other. In the old days, it used to be by mail or phone. Now it's email and that kind of thing. But I don't do Twitter yet, so it's not going up with that. These kind of represent what I see as important. They're not all exclusive, and they may not apply to you, and there are lots of other things you could add. And you know, if you give me a good suggestion, I'll put it in there. I think I'm thinking about putting this in one of my Borderland columns for Sunstone. The latest issue that's coming out is going to be the 40th column for me. Dan and I kind of started this Borderlands column up about 10 years ago, and for the first few years he held my hand while we went through it. I appreciate very much all the things he helped me with. But anyway, let's take a look at the very first idea, the one about, okay, I try to be honest with myself. I seek to know the sources of my motivations. You know, if you want to be a successful Borderland, if you've decided, look, I got to hang in here, these might help. And the second one is kind of related to it. I recognize that I may be suffering a loss, and I'm managing my loss emotions. The reason I bring this up is because both have to do with the idea initially of denial. Oh, this can't be happening to me. And we had, you know, that Kubler-Ross formula about what people do when they're when they have a loss of a spouse or a home or you know, their job or whatever it is. And those are major losses. And she suggested that we go things, you know, through a little steps of denial and then anger and depression and then finally bargaining with ourselves and with others and then finally acceptance of our situation. That doesn't all apply to everybody, and there are people who disagree with it, but it's, I've seen it enough that I've experienced it in my own life to some degree. You may not ever have every step, but eventually you have to get to the point where you give up denying and you get to the bargaining phase, which means bargaining with yourself and bargaining with others, and then eventually to an acceptance stage. And you know, what kind of loss are we talking about? A loss of a testimony? Or the loss of expectation that we will have a testimony? I mean, I just recently had an email from somebody saying they spend a whole week fasting and praying, knowing at the end of that week they're going to have a firm testimony. Well, guess what? They didn't get it. So now they really feel depressed and upset and angry, and what am I going to do? So, of course, then we talk. But, so, remember, if you could be honest with yourself, if you could look for those deeper reasons, and on the last column of the little handout, it shows a column of the Borderlands column where I talk about these issues to some degree. In number 38, or was it 33? Number 33, I think there was one about why I stay. And it talks about honesty. And there's other columns, too, that talk about the issue of being honest with ourselves. And, you know, trying to look into ourselves and be honest. Why do I do this? Why do I need to do this? What are my real motivations? You know, if I come down below the presenting motives, what are the other ones way down in my subconscious? And you have to search and look and for those. Number three, I seek outside help when necessary and useful. I guess the one thing we have to recognize is that we can't do this ourselves. You know, we have to rely on others to help us. I mean, at the very least, you got to go to prayer and ask God to help you get through this thing. But if you have an understanding spouse, and that sometimes doesn't happen, I've got a good friend, his spouse is not accepting of it, so he's basically in the closet over it. But, you know, if you've got a spouse or family or friends or a good counselor, either LDS or non-LDS, I mean, our LDS Family Services people, they've heard this many, many times. If you get the right one, they can help you with it. And what you're looking for is to be objective and get somebody who can be understanding and maybe help you, give you some hints about what to do. So that number three can be useful. And a lot of us try to avoid that because it seems like weakness, but it isn't. And then number four, I am developing a personal religion that is compatible with the LDS model. The scriptures tell us that we're saved one by one, that we're working out our own salvation with fear and trembling and so forth in Philippians. What I suggest people do is kind of make a list. Here's the requirements of LDS. Here are the requirements that we think Jesus wants us to do. And here are the requirements that we think we want to do. And we see what the overlap is. See how much agreement there is between these two, whether these three columns. And adjust and accommodate and adopt what you can and adapt what you can. You know, you let faith replace testimony, for example. The church wants you to get a testimony. Well, I can't do that, but I have to have faith. Okay, I'll do it by faith. Some way you can find a way that will be justifiable to you and to others that you could stay. And, you know, if you need to ignore what you disagree with, that doesn't hurt either. So there's enough overlap there for most people to stay in the borderlands if they want to. Number five, I'm becoming a participating student of Mormonism and detaching myself emotionally from things that bother me. You know, all of us have, you're members of a Republican Party or a Democratic Party. No matter what party you're with, you're probably saying, I don't want to, they're doing the wrong thing. But you're not getting all upset about it because you're probably stepping aside and saying, well, if I was in there, I wouldn't do it that way. And sports is the same way, you know, whether you're BYU or Utah, whoever it is. If things are being, if they're losing, you could lose your temper, but, you know, most of us are able to kind of step outside ourselves and look at it. Well, look at, You know, even though Utah's losing, they got a great quarterback. So I don't know who came up with this idea, and I apologize for not, it's not my idea about the participating student of Mormonism, but it's been a great boon for me because I can kind of step aside and say, wow, that whole thing about the Mormon history is kind of interesting, isn't it? I don't have to get all upset about it anymore. And I think once we take this stance of, you know, I'm going to be a studier, you know, what are the sources of these things? What are the pros and cons? Become a scholar kind of thing of the religion. And then number six, I take plenty of time before making important decisions. That's my first recommendation for everybody that calls me or emails me with their, although they've had their crisis. You know, okay, just hold everything. Don't do anything. Just wait. You know, and that's, we've seen so many people jumping ship and all of a sudden they find themselves in 10,000 feet of water, you know, a mile away from the boat, and their family's up there and all their friends are up there and they're struggling to stay afloat. So, you know, it's best to kind of say, okay, wait a minute, I'll give this 3 months. Let's see what happens in 3 months or something. And, you know, the other thing is that studying, and I study things out in my mind. That was from Doctrine and Covenants 9:8. I love this scripture because it says study and mind. What does study mean? You know, get to do the research. It doesn't tell you not to do it. It says to study it out. And it says not in your heart, but in your mind. We don't just accept it by, okay, I'll just accept it. It says study it out in your mind. And of course, that's a scholarly, again, research kind of a tool. And if you, and of course, that takes time. So 2 years from now, you might know a lot more. And you might feel a lot better about things if you will give it the time and study it. Number seven, I find compromises to solutions and problems related to my borderline status. You may have heard the story, but it's an important one for me. When I was 20 years old, my bishop called me and said, you know, all your friends have gone on a mission. You haven't gone yet. I said, well, you know how I feel about this. You know, I don't really have testimony. I'm not going out there and testifying something I don't really believe in. So he and I worked out a deal. He said, well, you know, I'll get in touch with the missionary department. How about going to Japan? You don't have to convert people to Mormonism. Convert them to Christianity. You okay with Christianity? Yeah. In fact, when I got to Japan, I went to Japan and we found out that in the Japanese language, nobody ever says they know anything. They say they believe. Well, I was able to say, well, you know, I kind of believe this. So, but I did believe it. You know, looking at the Japanese lifestyle, based on the what they had there, I thought Christianity was a better program. I could genuinely say, this will be better for you if you'll join with us. You're becoming a Christian. A Mormon Christian, but that's okay. And, you know, I had good success. I had 60 baptisms over there. So, and people seem to want to be Christian. They liked the Americans. Things are different now. okay, so be sure you find solutions and compromises. Keep your sense of humor about your issues. Number eight, look for the humor in the whole situation. Look for the irony. Look for the paradox. You know, Robert Kirby's a perfect example of that. You read his columns on Saturday. He gave a game of session 4 or 5 years ago with this borderline decision. You know, I've got a new book. I've been trying to look at the humor of these things. I got a new book out called Eternal Borderlands, and it's a satire about five people going from the pre-existence through the afterlife, and two of them are in the borderlands and their experiences. And you know, and the twist is, one's in the borderlands of, you know, Mormonism, and the other one's in the borderlands of the satanic tempters. He can't just fit in with those guys. So, you know, what their experiences are and so forth. And so, you know, it's so funny if you think all the things about it. One of the borderland character I have in pre-existence, she decides not to be born in the last days. She was the valiant person, but she decided not to be born in the last days. You know, kind of, if you think about it that way, it kind of gets kind of funny, you know. This whole thing has kind of got a comical side to it. Another one is, you know, they say those are in the top tier of the celestial kingdom. They're going to have, they're going to be sexually activated. Well, how does that happen? So in my story, I've got a funny little satiric thing about you go to a machine and you get, you know, you got to wait 1,500 days, but you get into your machine, it's over. So anyway, if we look at these things, kind of the humor that can be part of our lives, it'll help you to get through this. At number 9, I look for the good and accentuate the positive. You know, there's always some good things. After I recognized that I wasn't going to get a testimony, I felt more free to think and more curious. My curiosity was okay. I felt the pressure was off. I think a lot of people feel that. It's over with. You know, I can have friends outside the world of our world. You know, I can do service for other people besides the church. I don't feel as much guilt. If I don't want to go to the ward picnic, I don't go. So that kind of gives you some ideas of some of the positive aspects. So number 10, I'm honest but tactful with others. So right starting here, we kind of look to how we deal with others. We have to be careful, you know, we have to be honest with others. No blatant lies. I mean, honesty is a difficult situation because we never know exactly what means honest. So you don't want to be blatant about your about any lies. And don't let your silence lie to people. And don't be brutally honest with people. Are you crazy? You believe that? We have to be careful because other people aren't quite ready for some of the facts that we know. And so we have to let those people have their lives and don't hurt other people. So you have to be circumspect in your honesty. Number 11, I put my family and spouse first in my decisions and actions. My love for them governs my behaviors and attitudes. You know, we're told that family relationships are eternal, which makes it very important that we keep the family together. But if it's not eternal, then it becomes more important to have it right on this life. So don't go screwing up your family just because you're in trouble. You know, so keep that in mind. And let your love for them govern how you decide. I got one story in the next Borderlands column about a woman who wants to go back to church with her husband. She's not even a member, but her husband wants her to go and so forth. And she feels like she's in the Borderlands, even though she is in the Borderlands, even though she's not a member. So there's those issues, and she's putting her family first, so I really applaud that. Number 12, I let others have live their religious lives as they see fit. I don't try to convert others to my way of thinking. The church used to have a program, one person, one program, and that's kind of the way I think God has it. Every single person that's ever lived probably has some kind of a special relationship with God. And in my way of thinking, we can't really understand exactly what God set up here as a test for everybody. We're all here for some reason. I'm not sure exactly why. I don't have a firm testimony of exactly what's going on. We do have to let others believe what they want to believe and live their life the way they want to live it and be judged based on what they did and what they believed in. Maybe God judges us on whether we followed what we believe. I don't know, but we have to respect other people, and so we don't try to convert other people to our way of thinking. Just let them have their way, and you'll find yourself in the Borderlands a lot more comfortable. And finally, I'm learning to communicate well. The only way we can really get through this thing is to be able to talk intelligently with people, listen to what they have to say, speak clearly, value others. But this is a learned skill. We have to learn how to do it. And so I've got my book, How to Do I Love You, came out in one of those columns. And you can go to my website and download that for free. And if you're interested in learning skills, communication skills, that book could help. And there's lots of other things that could help. So and my book, For Those Who Wonder, is also for free download on my website. All the columns are also there. So if you want to, I brought a few extra copies too. So if you've never seen my book, For Those Who Wonder, if you want to get I've got a couple, three copies up here. You could come and get one afterward. But you can get a download for free. This book talks about the borderline issue. So anyway, that's my presentation for today. I'd like now to introduce Brad Carmack, who will talk to us. Of all the 40 columns that I've had and all the people's stories that we have told, Brad is the very first person who said, just use my name. There have been other cases where somebody said, well, you could use your name if you want to, but I thought for myself, no, probably better not. But in this case, I think it's a great thing, and all of us need to be a little more upfront, following these rules, of course, about what our situation is. So I'm going to turn the time over to Brad. Brad, this is the microphone. You just need to kind of angle your talk to
it. Sure. It'll pick it up pretty good.
Yeah, okay.
I hope you don't mind if I stand. I couldn't see some people in the back, and so I figured you probably can't see me either.
Yeah, please do stand.
I'm an active Mormon, believing, have been for a long time, born and raised in a pretty stereotypical, normal family in Meridian, Idaho, in the southwest part of the state. I just graduated from BYU in April, and I'll circle back around to that story a little bit more as we go on. But I'm going to tell a little about my story of entering the borderlands. The purpose of this panel is to talk about success in the borderlands, and I will emphasize a couple activities that I think might be helpful for you, suggestions to do if you find yourself in a similar place in the borderlands to mitigate some of the difficulties. But I'll be upfront, I still struggle. I have cognitive dissonance and faith crises and family and relationship issues that are all sort of brought up together that I hadn't really all resolved, so I'm kind of working through it myself at the moment. But I was pretty stereotypical, as kind of a Mr. BYU kind of type. I went to BYU for 8 years. I got three degrees there, and I did about everything there, all the intramurals, tons of dating, a lot of extracurricular activities, and of course took a class in a lot of disciplines. Really enjoyed my experience there. Kind of a two-edged sword, the BYU education. On the one hand, I love truth, and it gave me some robust skills, critical thinking, education, a lot of areas, to be able to make connections between different disciplines and to be able to analyze claims and to be able to do research. Not only to learn more about the world, but to learn about how to learn about it. And I really value that set of skills. The other side, the darker side, has been caused me to question a lot of the assumptions that I've had, a lot of the dreams and desires and goals that I have in my life, and of course my conclusions about the truth claims that are made in the institutional church. So it's been tough when you start to critically analyze. Ms. Pratt talked in her recent address about the difference between automatic thinking and controlled thinking. Controlled thinking is more critical and analytical versus automatic thinking, which is something that we all do, and that's was really helpful for us, helped us get through the day. But it's uncomfortable, at least for me, to be so often in that critical space. But being in that control thinking area, it does have its reward in being able to be more settled with the beliefs that you hold dear and with the trajectory that you take in life. Anyway, so it was only a couple years ago that I started sort of traipsing out of mainstream sort of literal understanding of the gospel in the world. Mr. BYU to the T, and kind of started to depart a little bit. For me, it kind of centered around issues with homosexuality. I wrote a book on the subject last year. I'm a straight guy. I never really had homosexual issues on my radar at all, but I'm a biologist, and there was a professor that I had that taught cell biology at BYU, his name's Bill Bradshaw. And outside of class, I heard him give a lecture on the biological origins of homosexuality, which is a thing I had never before supposed, that there was a biological origin. I never really thought about it, but if you had pressed me on it, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, I just figured it was straight people doing perverse things, you know. But turns out there's this whole biology. It's, you know, it made a lot of sense when you kind of delve into the research, that sexual orientation is an aspect of sex determination. It's kind of a subset of brain development, and the default status is the female default, which is an orientation towards men. A lot of steps have to go correctly to have a sexual orientation towards women. That's sort of beside the point, but definitely learning about the biology of homosexual orientation kind of cued me into this world and this space of Mormons and their stories and experiences, gay Mormons in the church, because of the things that have been said. And I'm presenting on Saturday on why Mormonism can abide gay marriage and kind of a lot of associate issues with the struggle that gay people have had in the church surrounding the orientation and people's response to it. Anyway, so that's sort of the foundation for the kind of coming out process into the borderlands of questioning. I was very nervous, of course, going to BYU. whether I'd be able to graduate. And at this point, I wrote this book last year, so I was in my last of 4 years of grad school. I was doing a joint degree, so I had two graduate degrees on the line. I was aware of other professors that had lost their teaching positions, other students that hadn't been allowed to graduate. My own brother, in his last year at BYU, he decided to be atheist in his last year, and he refused to hide it. And so, as a consequence, he never graduated because he couldn't get his ecclesiastical endorsement. As some of you probably know, maybe others don't, that the BYU Honor Code, if you come Mormon, the only way you can graduate is if you leave Mormon. You can come Catholic and turn Mormon later, that's fine. Or you can come Catholic and leave Catholic, but you can't come Mormon and leave Catholic. It's something I've fought against a lot, talked to vice presidents and stuff. That's kind of another issue, kind of scary talking to vice presidents about. It's a bit of a holy grail. You don't want to touch the religious freedom issue at BYU, which I think is a huge irony, since it's a religious institution, and we tend to like religious freedom, and in fact we lay claim to it as an institutional church with great vigor, but at the personal individual level, sometimes we don't offer that in our communities, and that's true, I think, at BYU as well. Just a little bit more on that issue. Yeah, there was a book by, I think, Jeffrey Arnett that came out about emerging adulthood, that age between 18 and 30, and a lot of people during that time, they depart from their childhood religions. It's very common for people to switch religions or become atheist or non-religious during that time. At BYU, it's not that much of an exception. Turns out there's hundreds, if not thousands, of students at BYU that lose their religions or their religious faith or they want to be atheists. A lot of them are closeted. And that kind of brings me around to my point here about being in the borderlands and being open. My commitment to transparency and being open comes because I value being able to work through the issues that I struggle with greater efficiency. I don't always resolve them, but I feel like I'm able to plow through them a little bit better when I'm open about them than when I'm not. And one of the suggestions, I told you I'd have three suggestions for activities that might be useful for you. One is to find a forum. Find somewhere where you can talk about the issues that are bothering you or that you care about. For me, that was a blog. I never really got into the blogging world until about 2 years ago. I formed my own blog, and it has been wonderful to be open on that. Some people use a pseudonym, so they have an avatar. It's not your real name. I used my own. But have somewhere, a friend, a diary. For me, it was a blog. Something where you can be open and authentic about what you're struggling with and what your doubts are, what you care about. For me, it's been helpful because I've been able to say, this is what I think on a subject, do some research, and then put it there. And then I can step away and move on to something else that I care about. Instead of having to stay there and sort of, you know, marinate in your own juices for a long time. I've been able to put it there. I can come back and revisit it later and add to it. But that's been helpful exercise for me to have a reservoir to be able to put my concerns and doubts. The second activity that I've found to be helpful is to find a community or forum where you can talk with others that are similarly curious. Not everyone's curious and cares about issues. Automatic versus controlled thinking. A lot of people kind of go through most of life primarily in sort of automatic thinking mode. I think all of us do to an extent. But it's been useful for me to find vigorous intellectual communities. The Mormon Stories podcast group has been one for me. I'm on the board of directors for the Mormon Transhumanist Association. That's been a very rich intellectual community for me. So finding some community where you fit in, where you feel you can contribute, and we have others that have a similar education is helpful, but at least a similar level of curiosity to talk about the issues that you care about. I'll tell you, there is a rich community out there on almost any issue. I've found a whole world of Mormon homosexual issues, of communities and discussion and dialogue and articles. I care about feminism too. There's a lot of blogs and books and things on those subjects. Mormon history. You're all here. You're probably in touch with a number of scholars and sources. So those are all useful for doing research, for connecting with others, for contributing and participating, as well as learning. I guess to follow up on the story of BYU, when I first came out, wrote this book, I decided to be transparent about that as well. So I sent a draft of my book to my bishop and to my parents and a bunch of other people. And I got talked to by a couple of deans at the law school, kind of warned that if I found a foul of the honor code that they couldn't help me and I'd be out. My bishop pulled me aside. He was worried about what I was writing. Talked about maybe calling a court if I was found too far off the line or whatever. But that was a scary time for me, and I spent a lot of months very nervous and anxious. But there were some good results. Ultimately, my bishop didn't take any action. In fact, he gave me some suggestions on how to improve the first chapter, which I appreciate his input. And I was able to communicate and touch base with a lot of other communities. I ended up being featured on the cover of Q Salt Lake. It's a GLBT magazine newspaper in Salt Lake. I was able to do an interview there, interviewed a couple of the radio spots, and I really cared about the message of my book, so that was helpful for me. I felt kind of called. It was important for me to take a stand on that issue, and being transparent and taking that risk was useful and had the good result of getting the message out more and helping me to communicate, touch base with other communities, both that were sort of in favor of the position I was forwarding that you'll hear about if you attend my session on Saturday, and also those who were opposed. But in any case, I've gained a lot of friends from it. Even though I still struggle with a lot of issues, I feel that I can go through them with greater efficiency. If I don't resolve them, I put them on the shelf. I feel connected with the community, and those have been some of the activities that have helped me through the last year, which has, quite frankly, been a bit exhausting and kind of difficult for me. But that's my story.
Okay, Brad, thanks so much. This is the kind of upcoming youth that we really admire. So I congratulate you for all you've accomplished in just your few short years. Compared to us, compared to me. Next, we have Mary Ellen Robertson. I don't think any of you need to be introduced to her. She's our program director here and has been working 23 and a half hours a day for the last couple of months on this conference, which is a tremendous job. And she's done a fantastic job. Really happy to have her join us. So if you want to stand, probably either stand up close to the microphone or stand at the podium or something. Unless you need your computer.
The computer.
Okay, well, maybe you could just bring it like you did that. Yeah.
One of the hallmarks of having this job and directing symposiums is you need to learn to be flexible. And if you aren't naturally flexible mentally and responsive-wise, you learn fast. I had intended to print this talk, and the printer isn't cooperating today. It was fine yesterday, though. So here I am with my technological assist.
Mary Ellen?
Yes.
You're going to have to speak a little louder.
I will. Is that better?
Well, I'm giving the people in the rear.
Can
you hear
okay?
In the back, you're hearing all right? Okay. I'll keep it at that level. Having grown up in the Western United States, being in the religious borderlands for me is something very much tied to the geography and the places that I've found myself over the past 25 years or so. Coming out as a borderlander and the success of those comings out have varied from place to place. And what I plan to do is share three stories about some of my experiences in the borderlands and describe what coming out has looked like in each instance. And at the end, I'll make a stab at describing what I felt were some of the successes in each situation. To some extent, I paged down too far. To some extent, I think I've always lived in the borderlands, but the first time it became really apparent was during my freshman year at BYU, in large part because I was one of those California Mormons. This was not a mere acknowledgement that I'd grown up in California, specifically Southern California and East Los Angeles. And being called a California Mormon was decidedly not a compliment. I would describe something I thought was innocuous about my experiences in my ward or stake, such as mutual activities, stake dances, what we did at seminary graduation, or mention that a lot of energy was spent on encouraging young people to finish high school and or discourage teen pregnancy. The response I would get from my Utah peers would be either to quickly disabuse me of the idea that that experience was normal, and they would almost immediately inquire, where did you grow up? Southern California. Okay, California Mormon. That explains a lot. Coming out in the BYU environment involved telling stories about my quirky ward and my especially quirky stake. Half the wards in my stake were Spanish-speaking. The other half spoke English. As one might imagine, this necessitated some adjustments in how meetings ran and how leadership functioned. My mom was stake primary president for a number of years, and since she was not fluent in Spanish herself, and couldn't even really order a taquito and pronounce that correctly, she had to have counselors who were bilingual in order to communicate with half of the women that she was supporting in their work as primary presidents. State conference was conducted in both languages, with speakers either giving their talk in one language and then switching to the other if they were fluent in both. And for those who weren't fluent, it meant having somebody stand right there and translate their talk sentence by sentence on the spot. And there was always a row of abuelitas, little grandmothers, in the front row with headphones, listening to simultaneous translation in Spanish. So this was what I saw every 6 months in state conference. Stake dances were a little touchy because the Hispanic kids and Anglo kids had very different tastes in music. And my ward peers would writhe on the floor to the sound of the B-52's song Rock Lobster, while the kids from the Spanish-speaking wards were like up against the walls, you know, hands off. They weren't going near that one. And they would request disco music. You know, this was the 80s, so they wanted to hear this music they liked from the DJ. And if at the end of the dance one group was unhappy with the music at the previous dance, they would angle to provide the DJ next time so that they would be able to enjoy the kind of music they preferred. Kind of a classic power struggle. At least for the slow dance songs, those seemed to be neutral territory for everybody. We sort of agreed that those were a good idea. Since I lived in the same stake until I left for college, this was my normal. I wasn't consciously aware that other stakes did things differently. I mean, you know, you can connect the dots, but I didn't really think about other stakes being different. And it was fairly unusual to have a stake configured this way, a fact that I appreciate much more now than I did as a teenager or a college freshman. And as much as my Utah and college peers would declare the approach they were most familiar with to be the one true way and argue their position's correctness, I would throw a wrench in things by saying, well, in my stake that wouldn't work, you know, due to the language barrier or whatever might impede a bilingual, racially diverse, economically challenged East Los Angeles stake from doing things the Utah way. So that's the start of my background. Borderland experience number two that I'll talk about today was the experience of living through California's Proposition 22 election, a ballot measure that changed the California Constitution to define marriage as being between a man and a woman, which stirred the anti-same-sex marriage pot 8 years prior to when the pot boiled over with California's Proposition 8. I've written about this experience in an essay titled The Personal is Political, published in the December 2009 issue of Dialogue. Essentially, I came out as having a different opinion on same-sex marriage by writing letters to my stake presidency, my bishopric, and my ward Relief Society president. Didn't want to leave her out, right? Indicating that the politicking at church regarding Prop 22 was messing with my spiritual equilibrium. And to put it mildly, you know, way, way out of kilter. And that I intended to bow out of attending church between the 8 weeks from the time that I wrote this letter to them and the election. Initially, I considered this stance to be one of being a conscientious objector, sharing my views with my immediate church leaders and saying, I'm opting out of this. This isn't working for me. However, when my stake president quoted parts of my letter in a ward conference and employed it as a cautionary tale about how not to think about the issue, I went from conscientious objector to activist. And this took the shape of phone banking for the No on 22 campaign. And I also poked the tiger a little bit by calling my stake president out on how he handled this. I heard from a friend who was in the audience of this ward conference and knew I had written the letter that the stake president was quoting to God and everyone. And so I called the stake president that Sunday afternoon and said, I understand you read parts of my letter in Alhambra Ward Conference. If you had a problem with what I said, aren't you supposed to talk to me about it? Isn't this the protocol? Yeah, that went over really well. initially, he tried to cast doubt on how I knew what he had said at this meeting when I wasn't present myself. And when that didn't fly, he kind of went full frontal and said my views on same-sex marriage put me on the slippery slope to apostasy, and I better not tell anybody else about my opinions. And I said, you told ward conference. you have disseminated this information. I sent my letter to seven people. And you spoke at ward conference. You've done more to spread this than I have. And the call got uncomfortably heated. And I thank God for call waiting, which interrupted his tirade. And when I clicked over to the other line, and I would have talked to anyone, telemarketer, fundraisers, political pollsters, anyone. But it turned out to be a member of my ward's bishopric on the other line, calling to thank me for writing that letter. And God bless him, because I just heard something really the opposite from the leader just above him. And that was scary. You know, I know the feeling of, okay, yeah, I poked the tiger, but what have I done now? How bad is it going to get? You know, what's going to happen? And so it was really comforting to know I had an ally, to know I had someone who I had shared these feelings and opinions with, who appreciated them and lamented the fact that his position in the bishopric really prevented him from saying anything about his own personal views on the topic. And not only that, he had to read letters from Utah, from the higher ups, saying what, you know, the one true position was supposed to be. So he was in a pretty uncomfortable position himself. And it was really comforting to know that I wasn't alone in this particular stretch of the California borderlands. My third borderlander story takes place on the actual border. In the Wild West border town of McAllen, Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley, about as far south as the United States extends. And it's a place best described as not Mexico, but barely Texas. And somebody said, it's as if the U.S. invaded Mexico and solved about half of their social problems. That was like the ward gave us the warmest welcoming I have had anywhere as a new move-in in a new ward. And I decided that in this new environment where no man knew my history, or any woman knew my history, that I would be open about my feelings, beliefs, and experiences, and doubts. And at the time, my doubts weren't so much along theological lines. They were a little more in the feminist camp, and along the lines of being doubtful about things that other people considered unquestioned certainties. For example, was the push to have members clean the meeting houses every week really about saving our souls through service, or was it about saving money on custodial fees? Okay. Who knows? I wasn't so certain it was the former. The ward was high in needs, without a whole lot of bodies to fill the available openings in leadership callings. And so it wasn't long before the bishop came calling with a calling. For me, that was Relief Society secretary and newsletter editor. I quickly ran afoul of community norms by wearing pants to a midweek Relief Society presidency meeting. And I arrived in the parking lot the same time as the bishop's wife, and she was one of the counselors in the presidency. And we sort of walked in together, and she was very dressed up. I wasn't. And she didn't say directly that we expect you to wear Sunday clothes to these meetings, but her passive-aggressive comment communicated just as much. According to the unwritten order of things, we were supposed to wear dresses or skirts to presidency meetings because, one, they were held at the church building, and two, we might go out afterward to visit less active sisters. During my year and a half tenure as Relief Society secretary, we never actually did go visit less active sisters, but the unstated expectation was that we would be dressed for it regardless. Never mind that being totally dressed up might make the visitees as uncomfortable as us showing up unannounced in the first place. It's just ooky. Essentially, I came out every time I made a comment in Sunday school or Relief Society that demonstrated a tolerance for gay people, Democrats, disaffected or inactive Mormons, or said that my reading of the gospel demanded care and mindfulness and love toward our undocumented sisters and brothers from neighboring Mexico. And this being a border town, it was pretty porous. You know, there were undocumented folks in my ward, in our stake, in leadership callings, and their children. Some of their children, you know, if they were documented, sometimes their children weren't, and vice versa. So it was a very delicate balance, and you can't tell by looking if somebody has, you know, documentation. Sometimes in these situations, I I got the sense of being dismissed as a kooky Californian or a weird transplant who was just, you know, hopelessly unfamiliar and not clued in on the realities of living in the Rio Grande Valley. And I'm sure on some level that was true at times. But every so often I would get approached by someone after a meeting, after I'd made a comment, who appreciated the fact that I had spoken up. Sometimes they had a gay relative, or they felt like they couldn't speak their truth so openly, or they were a closeted feminist kind of wondering, you know, is this really how it's supposed to work? And so even though it was often socially difficult to be that person saying that stuff all the time, I wanted to do my best to fly the flag and let the people around me know where I stood. And that they had a sympathetic ally if they needed one and hadn't ever had one at church before. Well, you know, you can sit by me, you know, we'll have a fun conversation. All right, so the storytelling aside, now comes the question, how to measure success in these Borderlander episodes? I'm not sure how successful I was as a BYU freshman talking to my peers about the practical necessity of adjusting how we run things in the church to accommodate unique situations or the demands of a particular geographical area or language barriers or things like that. I did my best to introduce a new idea where previously none had existed. And that was kind of what going to college was all about. Even at BYU, you know, you learn new things, right? I don't know if I broadened anyone's opinions, let alone changed their outlook, but I felt it was important to share those experiences, regardless of whether they just waved them off as California Mormon malarkey. I still wanted to describe what those experiences had been. And regarding the episode of Proposition 22, I measured success as being true to my convictions, even in the face of opposition and ecclesiastical backlash. And I did start attending church again after the election, which seemed to kind of surprise my stake president. He was also in my ward, even though that's what I said I would do in my letter. You know, it's like, I want out while you guys are, you know, rallying at church. So I'll be back when you're done. And we all know which direction this election is going. In any way, it's been predicted, you know, pretty accurately from the beginning and millions of dollars later. Yeah, it came out that way. So, you know, I showed up again when the ticker tape and everything had, you know, gone to ground. And I guess I would consider it part of the success that 18 months after this particular episode, the stake president called me into his office and apologized for the way that he had treated me during that phone conversation. He was a lawyer by profession, no offense. But he had inappropriately bared his professional teeth in treating me as an opponent when we were talking about something of ecclesiastical and practical import. And he realized that he was wrong to do that. And I appreciated and accepted the apology and realized that it probably came at some cost to him to admit that he had been wrong in how he approached things. We both stayed on the same side of the issue that we had at the beginning. But there was some movement. You know, he acknowledged something that he had done that was, you know, not appropriate and said something to me about it. He didn't just, you know, carry that around for his own knowledge. It was something he shared with me. And, you know, I'm glad that he felt unresolved enough to come and talk to me about it. I feel like my experiences in deep South Texas I would measure success as sharing some of those uncommon views and mind-stretching ideas as often as possible. And I knew I was making an impact, but not always what that impact was, necessarily. Occasionally, I would have people, you know, take me aside and say, I appreciated you saying that. And the Relief Society presidency did collectively unclench when it came to the dress code for weekday meetings, to the point that the Relief Society president herself started wearing not only pants, but jeans. Woo! And you know, how much does it matter what you wear to the meeting where you're talking about how to best minister to the people around you? I hope that the shift was to focus on that rather than what we had on. That's not important. And you know, I guess part of my struggle in trying to measure success and metrics and all that is that success is as varied as the Borderlander experiences themselves are. I appreciate Jeff's recommendation that we look for the humor in the situation. And, you know, I heard some chuckling out there, so I think you appreciated the humor that I found and incorporated into my remarks. And I acknowledge and realize that while you're in the middle of it, that eye of the hurricane, sometimes it's hard to find something funny. But, you know, with some hindsight, I can laugh about being a California Mormon and you know, maybe actually use that to my advantage in saying other outlandish Borderlander things around people, especially fun in my Ogden ward. And I can chuckle at the idea that anyone thought it mattered what we wore to a presidency meeting. And I can joke about, you know, kind of watching the heads explode all over the room when my calling at church provides me with a platform to say, look at all this Borderlander territory we have to explore. That said, it's also been important for me to be mindful about being kind to the people around me and to not treat opinions that differ from mine as somehow less than or misguided or lacking. I don't like when people treat my outlandish ideas as misguided or wrong. So I don't want to do that to other people. And I think probably I would say the best measure of success in the Borderlands is hearing somebody sincerely say, wow, I never thought about it that way. Or, huh, that's an interesting idea. And, you know, oh, I think I'm going to go think about that. So just introducing and planting that seed, I think, can sometimes be enough to call it a success. Thank you.
Last but not least, for sure, we have Dan Witherspoon, who is the most immediate past editor of Sunstone and kept Sunstone going for quite a few years, and we really owe a lot to him for all of his service, but I'll turn the time over to Dan.
Sessions like this, I know you all came, many of you, with stories to share, so I think I'm going to pretty much abandon this and just sort of tell you the end from the beginning. When I heard the word success in the title, you had to say, what is success? And immediately, you know, the overwhelming feeling for me was, it's not being done, because we're never done. Anything worth doing, we're never finished with it. And so whatever success means, it's a process, it's a journey. We talked about coming out as sort of the focus, and it made me start to think, is it a good idea to formally come out with people, or, you know, or what would be a strategy? And I look like in the stories I would have told you in my own life, and I've told them through Sunstone editorials of you know, accidentally coming out to my wife just in the course of having conversations about some of the things I was studying in grad school, where I'm deconstructing religion, you know, and the difficulties and the poor. It's not an ideal way to do it. And I'll come back to that point in a second. And then a very poor way of coming out to my bishop in a new ward at a time when I'd kind of had my big trouble during grad school. We had moved to San Dimas, California, and had just a really good ward experience. But it was also the time when I was writing my dissertation, and it was on Mormonism, and it was on the things I liked in Mormonism. So somehow or other, the things that I would typically do at other times, I was immersed for 2 years, you know, writing a dissertation on stuff that I thought was profound and wonderful. So then we moved to Bountiful, Utah, and I struggled. And I started attending the Unitarian Church the same Sundays I would attend the Mormon Church, because I didn't know if I could stay. But luckily, Tom Rogers was in my ward, and a fellow named Jeff Anderson works at the church historical department, and somehow or other we became friends, and I began to feel good about it. And so I sort of had left Bountiful, you know, feeling like I was successfully managing the chaos within Mormonism. We go to a new ward, sort of a standoffish opening and things like that. We're in there about 4 or 5 months, and it's tithing settlement time. And my wife goes, and she mentions to the bishop, at least she comes home and tells me that, you know, well, Dan, you know, because he asked about me why I wasn't there or whatever. And she goes, well, you know, he's struggling, da-da-da-da-da. He doesn't, he's not sure what he believes about all this stuff. And so then he comes over like 2 weeks later to offer me a calling. And just in the course of the calling, I'm kind of like, wow, I was surprised to get a calling offer here. I thought my wife told you I was pretty much having struggles. He goes, oh, she may have mentioned that, but what, you know, whatever it is. He goes, oh, so what are your struggles? And then, you know, I've recounted this, and this is one of those most powerful experiences of my life. I screwed up so bad because all I could tell him was the things I didn't believe anymore. I didn't have that language to say, you know, we all know that when we begin this journey, we sense that we're on it, not because we're losing something, it's because we're gaining something. But there's those. But to somebody else, it's like, you're losing surety. You're losing all those things. You are not the person that I am before. They experience you as losing, and even though you're experiencing gaining, and there's that years. I'm that's really where I'm getting to. Here's the end from the beginning. It's years. And where I ended up focusing after success and coming out and stuff like that is owning our own part. And our own part in not just thinking that some magic formula of here's how you come out, or here's this is going to do it. It's our internal work that I think is such a big piece of that. So that's where I was going to focus. So anyway, the long story short of the bishop thing was no calling. A year and a half later, I have been attending, and my son turns 12, and I want to ordain him. I want to participate in that ordinance, and he says no, because we weren't able to make peace with the things I'd sort of told him, which were not quite sure what's going on with that atonement thing. That was the one that finally landed him. But again, that led to also some very positive things, and I've written and shared about those a few times. But anyway, end from the beginning, because I know you want to have a chance to share. Profound line in Dale Lefman's session this morning was offered by Barry Laga, who I also went to his session right after that. I highly recommend you getting the thing on that. The comment was, how we see determines what we see. And that how we see, and Dale actually did a very good job. He talked about the lenses that we bring to Scripture. You know, we got to be careful, because those lenses are going to determine what we see there. And the same thing, and there's But Dale Lefman's piece was, if we read the Scriptures from a place of a transformed heart, a true Christian attitude, we are going to be able to see beyond, in his case, he was talking about some 19th century inheritances from Joseph Smith's time or whatnot that he thought was in the thing. But we'll always see, you know, the bad characterizations of God as being not the true ones. That, you know, like Lowell Bunyan finally ended up saying somewhere, he says, whenever I'm looking at Scripture, I'm always going to choose the view of God that I've met through Jesus Christ. My encounter with Jesus Christ is going to tell me. So God can be explaining to people that they should kill everybody. You know, from my transformed heart, I know that that's not God. So that was sort of a point there. So I guess let me share very well-worn territory here. Gene England, what's life all about? It's a school of love. And why is the church as true as the gospel? Because it's school, baby. and what's a school we don't ever graduate from, because we can never fully love as much. It's a school of patience. It's a school of frustration. But our part of this, we have an accountability too. We can't expect just them to change. We're constantly saying, well, I had a thing about the Greeks, the good, the true, and the beautiful, that we focus so much on. A lot of us that go into the borderlines, you were talking about studying out in your mind, we're all head cases. You know? That's the true part of it. But we have to see the good. We have to see the beautiful. We need to do that. And all those things are in our words too. And somehow or other, for me, part of that transforming process was to just look at that and to see the power and the beauty of the parents struggling with the autistic children and having to face the judgment of the people who don't know that that child's autistic, or, you know, the different people, just the gorgeous hearts of the man who gets up to give a talk this means so much to me, I know him, and he's not an articulate person, but all he could do is cry for 10 minutes. He probably literally got out 80, 90 words through that entire thing. But just to be able to see the beauty of that isn't there. So our own part of it is there. And here's, I guess, of all the different things I brought here, I've been reminded lately, I took impact training about 4 years ago. I don't know if you know what those are. It's the Deep Immersion Landmark Forum is a similar sort of thing. And I've been thinking about that positive, obviously, I considered it a very positive thing in my life. But, you know, as I'm there, I'm kind of well-read enough guy, and I recognize that pretty much all the theories that are behind the different trainings are things that you can read in self-help books. You know, there's a whole lot of that stuff there. But what I guess I say now is, you know, as soon as it gets a little hard and that self-help book has taken me to someplace where I don't really want to go, which is, I think, the common thing for all of us. We don't really want to go to those painful places. We don't really want to go to a place where we might have to change. We might have to get an honest feedback about our life and stuff like that. The thing about those things is we won't do it. But in the training, you're there for 4 days and you've paid some money. And you somehow or other you've committed to this, and you will look hard. And there will be processes that will finally, somewhere along the line, most likely break into those things, and gorgeous learning and new things there. And so I guess that's all I'm saying about borderlands in the church. If success means staying in the church as it will get to you. The goodness will get to you. The beauty will get to you if you are all open to it. And, you know, and just reading about it and thinking about it, or give me some little strategy that'll make it easier, that is just not, that's not going to lead to the deep transformative experience. I don't know, somewhere along the line, I don't have to change as much as the next person, but for whatever reason, just learning that I haven't got it figured out on a regular basis. Not fun, but also joyful. Is that making sense? So, anyway, offer that. Thank you.
Wow, I'm glad I drove up here from Salt Lake for hearing you three. Anyway, thanks so much. And we've seen the intellectual and the emotional here, so that's fantastic. We have about 15 minutes, and what we want to do is invite you to ask questions or maybe share with us or with the group something successful you've experienced. I would ask you, when you stand up, though, to make sure you're kind of speaking toward the microphone. You can even come up up here if you want to. But don't take more than, if you're sharing a story, don't take more than a minute or two so we can hear everybody who wants to speak. And if you have a question for a specific person, you know, address it to one of our panel. So do we have any comments or questions?
Well, I have an observation.
Do you want to stand up?
Yeah, sure.
Why don't you give us your name, too?
Okay, that's all right.
That's all right.
It's my first time.
That's all right.
Am I in a Borderlands test on me?
Yes.
So my observation is you're all very brave, okay? What about people who, and you've stood up and fought for what you believe, and I have ultimate respect for that. What about people who want to say are kind of emotionally or intellectually living in the borderlands? What can they do to? Is it okay for them to be in the borderlands without being as brave as you all are, and just kind of maybe focus on, say, you know, you're a teacher and you pick and choose the things that that make good sense to you and that you have a good feeling about, rather than and just kind of, you know, just kind of living under the radar, so to speak. I mean, is it okay to not, you know, bare your guts to everybody and kind of get on the bad list and be marked with the big red F on your forehead for being a feminist?
Let me just make one comment, then I'll invite you folks. The very first time I ever was involved with Sunstone with anything was a paper called The Phenomenon of the Closet Doubter, maybe 30 years ago. And, you know, the church, after that paper, they actually did a study, and they invited me to come down and review it with them at the correlation department. And they looked to see how many people really were in the closet. And they didn't give me the exact numbers, but it was pretty considerable. And so, yes, we've all been in the closet to begin with. You just have to decide for yourself when it's appropriate and the right time and the right situation to let your story be known. Some people stay in the closet their entire life and they do fine. So don't worry about that. It's when you have to bump up against, I'm being dishonest, or I can't live with myself, is when you have those issues to deal with. Then the rest of you would like to make a comment? Or?
My quick thought was you were asking permission to be yourself. Absolutely, you have permission to always be yourself. And then just my other quick thought was, it doesn't always have to be public. I mean, you know, this idea of bravery, I think in some ways might be associated with publicly, like lots of people need to know. I just, you know, those opportunities may come and you may feel it, but I don't feel like you're a failure if you're not being public. And especially when you're in the midst of those early chaotic years. I mean, seriously, for me, 7 or 8 years before I really could begin to articulate that this isn't loss, this is gain, or at least this has been a good thing for me or something. And so when you're in those chaotic years, I'm so glad I didn't give Sunstone talks when I was all, you know, in the chaos of it. I'm glad I didn't write that, and then I have those things to, like, you know, I have to, you know, just honor your journey and be yourself, and you'll be great, I think.
And I think a commonality between the three of us is that this has been a process of years in the making where you take that first tentative step and say, this isn't adding up for me. And then the next time it might be, well, that's kind of hard to swallow for a feminist. Or, you know, it's those little steps toward, you know, at least that was my experience. There were little steps leading up to the big, you know, poking the state president. You know, where that wasn't the first thing out of the gate that I did. But I got to a point where it's like, okay, I've reached my limit. I can't be silent on this issue anymore. I have to say something. And everybody has a different point where they hit that ceiling. And I think it's great to do those little things along the way, like say, well, it would be difficult for me to sincerely cover this section of a lesson in primary or young women's or Relief Society. How about I focus on what I can sincerely share, what touches me, what is important in discipleship as a general process of refining that we learn in this life. So it's not, you know, I mean, I look at it and I think, maybe I was more crazy than brave, but it looks different in hindsight than it did at the time. And it's a process, and you all, you know, everybody's road might be a little differently laid out.
Okay, thanks. Someone else had a hand.
Oh, I just wanted to ask Brad what his blog is.
Oh, yeah. My blog is bradcarmack.blogspot.com. Bradcarmack.blogspot.com. It's got my book and YouTube version in PDF. And got hundreds and hundreds of pages on all sorts of subjects. You're welcome to go there.
Can you put the title of your book as well?
Yeah, the title of my book is Homosexuality, A Straight BYU Student's Perspective. Homosexuality, A Straight BYU Student's Perspective. I'll be selling copies and signing on Saturday, and you can again get it in PDF for, I made like a hours long series of YouTube videos if you happen to like watching instead of, or listening instead of reading.
Okay, great. Yes, ma'am.
Part of my thing with the borderline is there have been times in my life where I've gotten an aha moment about something in the gospel that suddenly made sense. You know, I was raised in a part member family, and my mother used to say, well, the reason the church has family home meeting on Monday is because the men are always out home teaching and doing other church colleagues the rest of the week, so it's the only time they get to see their family. So she really put down that home teaching kind of stuff. And when my husband was called to be an elders quorum president, he had 17 people to home teach that were all inactive or ready to leave the church. And I thought, oh, this is going to be terrible. But he came home from that experience with such a beautiful spirit that I thought, oh, wow, maybe there is something here. And so I've had some of those kind of experiences. But on the other hand, I'm still struggling with a lot of other things. And one of them is the temple right now for me. But I still want a temple recommend. So when I go to the interview and they ask all the questions, I can say yes appropriately for everything except the restoration. And then I say, I'm working on it. And so far, that's worked.
Good tip.
So I wanted to know, how do you handle the temple recommend question stuff? I was so happy when they moved it to 2 years.
I think you hit it right on the head. Strangely enough, I've been a branch president, and I can tell you that almost every person that goes into the bishop's office, and I've been in the bishopric twice as the counselors, and you know, nobody answers. Well, we have a small percentage of people answer every question with a resounding yes. Everybody's got, well, you know, I don't know if I can quite say yes on that one, but you know, I'm trying, and I'll accept it, and yeah, I'm trying to be honest. So we're, nobody's at least have a little slight bit of humility is going to, you know, come up with a straight yes on every answer. So don't worry about that, and most bishops will go along with you if you have the right spirit about it and you have the right attitude about it. And you want to go to the temple. Start right out at the beginning. I want a temple recommend. See what we can do to get one. And let's have open the panel. Anybody had any experience with that?
Well,
Pat Brad.
I just got my temple recommend a couple weeks ago. It is a bit of a struggle, I thought. I mean, some of them I feel I can substantially answer without too much trouble. Like, I just try to be honest. And, you know, that one's not too bad. And, you know, how do you treat your family in accordance with the principles of the gospel? I strongly, you know, I try to keep my behavior okay there. What I struggled with was the lockstep question about, you know, do you sympathize with anybody whose views are contrary to those that are put forth by the LDS Church? That's a pretty explicit one, you know. The LDS Church has pretty, you know, here they are. Do you sympathize with anybody that disagrees with these? I'm like, well, Yeah, I kind of do.
So,
I don't know.
You can wiggle around there.
Yeah, I guess that's not a very helpful answer.
Get the record?
Yes, I did.
Okay. There's the answer. You always have to have caveats. Well, I can sympathize with some of their things, you know. Great answers. You guys want to say anything?
I got my first temple recommend in South Texas and agonized over, you know, how I was going to approach this. And since it was my first recommend, I had to talk to the stake president, which I had not expected. And
same guy?
No, different guy. But I was thinking maybe I'll get the cool counselor instead, and you know, kind of navigated around that way. And the stake executive secretary said, "Nope, first time you got to go to the stake president." So at least I knew that going in, and I had been around him enough to know kind of what his views were, and so on the things that. On the questions that I had lots more to say about besides yes or no, I just kept my mouth shut. And that was the most honest way to deal with it, because I didn't expect any kind of positive or constructive interaction to come from really diving into these issues with this guy. He wasn't any kind of deep thinker. And it's not that I didn't like him as a person, he just didn't think about this stuff. He had a handbook. So he didn't need to think about it. And so I didn't want to open a can of worms that I couldn't unopen once it was the lid's off. So I just, you know, it was a calculated decision on my part to handle it that way. And I got a recommend, and unfortunately the barcode hadn't gotten to South Texas yet, so it wasn't valid anywhere except San Antonio, I guess. But I felt like I was walking a tightrope, and I'm sure he felt like he was conducting just another interview. So, and I think it's appropriate to be thoughtful in approaching that, and to have a sense of, you know, where would the ledge be, and do I want to step off the ledge if there's a pretty steep drop? And you know, I think it's a good thing to not go over ledges you don't need to go over.
Less is more. Yeah, my quick thought is I'm willing to sign it. So should he. I've thought about it. I've determined that. And then when it comes to the whole actual questions, there's so much more to something being true than being those words, that phrasing, there's intent, there's sensibility, all those things I honor about the gospel. And so I don't have any, less is more, none of his damn business. I'm willing to
sign. Okay, fantastic answers. Thanks. Someone else. We have one more question maybe. Now three hands. You're standing up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm Carl Braithwaite from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm a political scientist. And your borderland diagram doesn't quite fit me, but I can make it work.
Okay.
I'm pretty much a hardcore one, but with lots of borderland views and even dot views further. But I came to the kind of position I have when I was a graduate student in 1964. My brother was serving in Vietnam as one of the first advisors there. I looked enough at that war to decide that it was really a stupid war. I had friends who were leaving for Canada, and I thought, I'm not going to leave my country just over this. I'll stay inside and fight. And that's the same way I view a lot of things in the church, is that I'm fully involved in the church, but I will push back on issues, and I'm comfortable. It doesn't make me feel like I need to leap out. So there may be a few others like me.
Sure, sure.
Because I've held lots of significant positions in church callings. But it gives you a chance to at least occasionally test where you can push the other leadership some. And so people can be comfortable in that kind of position. And in fact, we need more people to stay in that category or else you miss the chance for dialogue with people.
Excellent thought. I had one time, this is hard to believe, but one time I was sitting on the stand and a bishop from another ward, I was on the high council, and a bishop from another ward was also on the stand sitting next to me, and he leaned over and he said, "Jeff, I think just the way you do." And I had a bishop from Tooele call me one time with the same story. But that, stay. If you can deal with it, stay. That's what we want. Congratulations.
It gets better.
One more there. Also.
I just wanted to mention the value of finding a few like-minded people. I mean, one of the things about being a little bit brave is that you make yourself available to other people in your ward who have questions. And there's like suddenly in my ward over the last few months, a lot of people inviting me to meetings with them, to how do I stay in the church, blah, 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 blah. I give them Jeff's book, and I talk about my history, and it's really valuable. Or find people in your ward who seem to be open, because coming here is a great thing, and it always has been for me. But having someone local is also really valuable.
No question about it. Thanks for the comment. Well, our time is up, and lunch is waiting. Thanks so much for being here.